the Samstag Museum of Arts On Art podcast. This podcast is recorded on the lands of the Kaurna people. And before we begin, I'd like to pause and pay my respects to Kaurna elders past, present and emerging. I'm Gillian Brown, curator at Samstag Museum. And for today's podcast, I had the pleasure of speaking with Pilar Mata-Dupont and Jessica Bunch. Pilar is a Latinx visual artist and filmmaker living and working between Rotterdam in the Netherlands and Boorloo, Perth in Australia. And her moving image work, The Ague, is showing at Samstag from the 22nd of October until the 10th of December. Jessica Bunch is a writer from Wales. She has a background in radio and has written for the BBC's main spoken word channel Radio 4 and BBC Music, and now works on The Archers, the world's longest running drama. Jessica is Pilar's collaborator in writing The Ague. The Ague focuses on Kew Gardens, the Royal Botanic Gardens in London, which houses the world's largest seed bank. Theatrical and intriguing, in Mata-Dupont's febrile work, scientific claims acquire increasingly irrational traits. Inspired by a case study of the cinchona tree and a short story by Virginia Woolf, it transports us to a botanical world in which truths and misinformation, colonial histories, and our ecological future coalesce. With a title referencing malaria-induced fever, The Ague leads us down a never-ending corridor to a hallucinatory state of broken timelines and unreliable narrators. In this place, the natural world is classified and collected, notionally driven by a contemporary ideal of preservation. But as the gradual tangling of history and fiction erodes certainty, an idea floats to the surface. The drive to preserve as a more palatable disguise for the colonial impulse to control. We've had the privilege of Pilar's trust in presenting this major work, made in 2018 and installed for the first time in Australia at Samstag in Adelaide, with Pilar consulting from her residence in Rotterdam. Her practice spans video, performance and photography and delves into the fallibility of structures of history, gender and memory. Using highly theatrical and cinematic methods, she reimagines histories and classical texts, creating alternative readings that question dominant narratives of Western society. Her Argentinian background and upbringing in Australia, Argentina and Brunei Darussalam, all settler states or former colonies, feeds into this practice. The fever dream of the Ague is propelled by the overlapping accounts of six characters occupying different times and locations. Their stories are carefully crafted through snippets of dialogue from which we can glean some of the competing forces on history, the social and the political, the active and the passive. Given the importance of narrative in this work, I was thrilled to be able to speak with both Pilar and Jessica. Our chat covered processes of collaboration, adaptation, and the power of storytelling. As we recorded this across three different countries, this conversation was conducted on Zoom, with all of the leaks from real life that brings. For example, you'll hear Jess's new baby, who she was caring for during our very early morning chat, make his first broadcast to the world. And a small correction to a fact mentioned, The Archers was first broadcast in 1951, making it 70 years old, not 75.
So I think what I'll do to begin with is just start with like really like base level stuff about how you came to work together, that kind of thing. If you want to start from that and we can kind of follow the project as it evolves, and I'll just listen to your conversation and go from there.
Yeah. So I knew Jess because Jess was living in Rotterdam for a while, and I knew Jess as well was writing fiction. And I particularly liked her voice, I know her speaking voice, but also from conversations with her, I felt she might be a good person to explore these characters with, or explore characters that had this particular Englishness that I felt I couldn't tap into. So yeah, then I asked Jess to work with me, and we had a lovely day at Kew Gardens together, which was a couple of days. We went to the Millennium Seed Bank as well, didn't we? Yeah, and then the character sort of came from, I mean, not only from Virginia Woolf's Kew Gardens texts, but through our conversations and through people we saw at Kew. Jess sort of, you know, I wanted to be able to work with someone who knew those voices, and who could write them. And so Jess did that.
And so Jess, your background as a scriptwriter in the UK, I'm interested in what Pilar just said there about capturing the Englishness of those voices? Was that something that came about through that particular visit, or was it something that you were chasing after, Pilar? And how did that fit in with your background in writing, Jess?
I think it's something that I saw a lot in the Virginia Woolf text, is an Englishness. And then definitely being at Kew Gardens, it was just so apparent how it was this grand day out, and how that for me felt like such an English sort of a thing. And not to mention the history of gardens and pleasure gardens and all of that. So I was really struck by how it was quintessentially English, but also I work on a radio soap opera that is the most, you know, village English thing that you could imagine. So I think these voices are, you know, always real to me, these characters, but they're people that I work with all the time in terms of our fictional characters on the radio show that I work on. But I hadn't written anything that was so I guess pompous and deliberately leaning into that naffness of that Englishness. So that was all sort of hammed up, I think, for this.
It's interesting because that is definitely something you pick up in watching the work, is a kind of naivety or kind of guilelessness to the characters who don't necessarily understand they're participating in this sort of colonial structure and that kind of location. So was that something that the two of you discussed as a point of reference or departure?
I just think we always, from the outset, knew that there was naivety about Kew Gardens, that you can experience that place on many levels. So I think that it was there from the off as well.
Yeah, I think, you know, even going back to Virginia Woolf's text, which seems to operate on many levels, in the sense that you have, you know, and we talked about this so many times, how she has this amazing ability to kind of zoom out, and then it's sort of colors and light and, you know, overlapping plants, and then it'll move down into a snail who's trying to move his way or her way across the ground, and then zoom out to these people who are sort of in this semi-dream state. There's this really beautiful moment where this woman, who she quite callously refers to as a ponderous working class woman, who sort of seems to see the plants for the first time, and it's mentioned that, you know, she's a sleeper waking, you know, almost like she's the only one who actually sees the plants, and everyone else is sort of in their own memories and in their own history. And I think that, I mean, that there was that, and then also what Jess said about the Kew Gardens itself being, I mean, you can really experience it just out for a picnic for an afternoon and not even consider how those plants got there, or you know, the structures that made it so that collection was possible.
People get engaged there and, you know, go on hen nights, and it's a fancier day out. It's, you know, it costs quite a lot of money, but there's an element of all of this special, you know, life events that happen at Kew, and yet it happens amongst all of these plants that have been pillaged and these invasive species. And there's something just really, as a writer, just very delicious about people not knowing things that, I mean, I wouldn't have known it unless we'd researched it. But yeah, I think that naivety is really important. And I didn't want to make fun of these people, but they are intrinsically funny, I hope.
I mean, that's a similarity, I think, with the Virginia Woolf story, because you do get this kind of wide-ranging view of class structure and of even just people's various stages of life and things like that come through, because I mean it's a story that unfolds through dialogue and observation, not so much the voice directly of a narrator. You know, they keep coming, these characters come in and weave through, and that's something that happens a little bit more complexly in your script, obviously, because they're layered over the top of each other. In Virginia's story, we obviously move from scene by scene, you know, from a fixed vantage point with the snail, I think it is, where people are passing by. But in this, we're on a sort of constant path through with all of those voices. So how did you go about that sort of weaving of those narratives together in a way that kind of departs from Virginia's source text?
So my background is a radio soap opera called The Archers. And in that, things are constantly weaved because it's a village community and people impact on each other all the time. And you are always trying to tell a bigger overarching story of the main events of something that's going on. But you're using every single side character to sort of comment on this bigger story. So that is just sort of the way that I work anyway. But with this, it was kind of the case that I think Pilar and I worked out quite a set journey for each pairs of characters. So Virginia and Bessie, for instance, the two women sort of going around, I almost had them in a loop going around queue, constantly going around queue. And this conversation must have happened thousands of times for them. And similarly, the tour guide and the tree. I mean, we had a cast of characters, and I feel like as soon as we set them up and set them running, we could have written it many different times, but that weaving would have always happened. I suppose you might want to talk about the edit of that.
Yeah, I mean, I was also thinking that the visuals, and I think I did this quite intuitively, but also I think coming from the text, because I think there was this whole idea of it being a kind of strange tour. And also because we went on this incredible tour at Q, which was completely crazy. But then, when I was filming, I was sort of always imagining, always somehow ended up going down some kind of straight corridor. Like most of the shots, there's a couple of sort of side dollies, but most of the shots are going straight down a corridor. So it's almost like there's a very much a feeling of traveling in the work. And then there's also referencing Virginia Woolf's text, like there's a lot of overlays, like basically every transition is an overlay. It's sort of, I think the weaving of the voices sort of fits very much with the weaving of the visuals. And you know, the whole feel of the work that I was trying to get across was that you're having a bit of a malaria, or a bit increasingly developing a malarial fever, which I had wonderfully confirmed by someone who had actually suffered a malarial fever. So that was a bit of a win. Yeah, so I feel like the interweaving sort of happened. I feel like that kind of happened quite naturally because there's the way that you wrote it and the way that I'd filmed it, and it sort of ended up becoming.
I think maybe it came from Pilar does more research than anyone I've ever worked with ever in my life. And it was brilliant. There was so much to read, and she was forever excited about any new thing that she'd read. That much material, and the way that we were approaching all of the material was with a flatness, not treating everything as equal, but definitely that feeling as though we didn't want to give judgment, because it's very easy with this to, I suppose, we didn't want to tread ground that had been tread, but we also just wanted to experience it like the Virginia Woolf short story, which is all at once, you know, the snail, the plants, the animals and the people are treated totally the same, each with their own viewpoint and journey in that story. And I think we did the same with the research here, which created the flatness, which created this confusion.
The work does that quite well, I think, in that obviously Virginia's story doesn't interweave time in the same way that your work does, Pilar, where we've got, we're sort of jumping across time zones and location, but there is this sense of, I think because you're sort of in the perspective, mostly this, you realize you're in this perspective of the snail, where you kind of have to take those little snippets as they're presented then and there. You don't have sort of wider context to those conversations, and it's the overlapping and the contrast between the characterization that starts to build all of that around the work. So does that mean then, if we're sort of thinking about this as you kind of descent into fever, do you think you were more driven by a vision of this as a work propelled by the auditory side of things, the script, and then the visuals came second, or was this something that you kind of conceived at the same time?
I'm trying to remember, because when we spoke last week about this, we realized how incredibly muddy everything was, in that I kind of set out to do an irrational research, which sounds like a very strange thing to say. And that's kind of exactly what we did. We sort of just like just said, pick bits and pieces. And I'd sort of been sneaking into Q for months. Like as soon as I could get over to the UK, I would just sneak in with a camera, and you're not really supposed to do that, and just start filming. And then we had like a you know, we had our trip there, and then there was sort of back and forth with that. So, I mean, I think it all sort of happened at the same time. It was sort of, I think we were continuing, like the research didn't stop.
Mm.
I think at some point I had to tell Jess to stop. Yeah, it just started going, just became this kind of massive thing. And so we had to sort of, at some point we were like, stop. Like, we have to, before it gets too out of control. Like, I feel like we could have made like a 1 hour film, I think, with all the footage, because I'd had so much footage as well. And then there was so much I had to cut out of the text, unfortunately. And there's still so much text in there. But yeah, I feel like the process of making the work is very much how the work turned out, in the sense that it was kind of an overlapping, weaving process that didn't have any kind of rational goal.
Like the setting of Q, you know, you go to these gardens and, you know, species are planted, and everything is just so messed up in terms of where things sit in these gardens. And I sort of feel like the reason the text and everything is so messed up is that if you're literally walking in a straight line, you will encounter such varied species of plant that, you know, when you're making notes about each plant. You know, you live with a book that's, you know, your notebook that's like totally jumbled because the whole place is jumbled and the whole history of the place is jumbled. So I sort of feel like there was a logic, and then the logic got screwed up by the place.
It's interesting because I think of these kinds of pleasure gardens as a particularly British that might be because I am British as well. So I just, that's the kind of context I view them in. But I keep going back to this idea, and I wish I could remember who this quote is from, but it's that gardens are unnatural spaces for the natural.
Is it Rebecca Solnit?
I think it might be.
In Wanderlust.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought about that a lot. Yeah.
And it's as you say, they are such jumbled things. And again, like, I think gardening is such a, I think a lot of British people see it as kind of inherent in their culture, but this idea as well that so many of the plants that they think of as native in the UK are actually, they're not. It's just that we've got hundreds of years of colonization and empire and travel packed into it, that these things have been in our gardens for hundreds of years, and it's just sort of changed people's views on what belongs where and alongside each other. Was that something that you were aware of, Pilar? Was that sort of what drew you to work in the garden, or was it really reading Virginia's story that triggered that?
Well, I'd made another film, a three-channel film called Undesirable Bodies with Form in Western Australia the year before, and that film was the first time I'd focused on a non-human entity as a protagonist. And in that, I had a number of protagonists in that film, and they were all invasive species that were in this very particular, it was kind of a small oasis in the Pilbara on Yindjibarndi country called Jindawarana. And what struck me was that these plants, you don't notice these plants when you walk through that landscape necessarily with an untrained eye, but as soon as you learn to recognize what they are, they kind of really jump out at you. And so I made them sort of these strange, you know, these date palms and these water lilies and these passion fruit flower vines, who are all, you know, planted there by European settlers and Afghan camel herders. Making them into protagonists sort of very much started directing me in thinking about, you know, non-human entities as protagonists. And that then got me to somehow, I don't know how I got there, but I got to Virginia Woolf's story, Kew Gardens. Yeah, and then from that grew this, because, of course, like, Kew's involvement in the colonial project, as much as it's sort of led with this scientific hat, was very much part of how, you know, the UK, the Netherlands, and pretty much all of Europe were able to penetrate, and I use that word purposefully, the southern hemisphere, basically, the entire southern hemisphere.
Yeah, I mean, we call them pleasure gardens, but they have a kind of inherently capitalist drive behind their creations.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting thing. So then that kind of exploration of colonialism and that kind of fever, I guess, that took over the people involved, I guess that makes your choice of non-human protagonist quite interesting, because in this story, the
Cinchona or Cinchona,
which I never
worked out how to actually pronounce it. It was partially named after a Spanish lady or some kind of royalty. So I kind of went with her pronunciation, but then yeah. I've heard people say Cinchona as well. What I also really loved about kind of the Carl Linnaeus naming structures is that people could be, it's kind of like this fake Latin. It's a bit like Harry Potter Latin, where, you know, anyone could come along and just make any word this weird Latin-esque sounding word. So I think that really made me giggle quite a lot, especially because, you know, people would discard native names for plants, which would have various meanings, which would, you know, relate to how it's planted, what it's used for, what time of the year it was used for, and then replace it with this completely nonsensical name. So as much as it has this horrible erasure of voices underneath it, like, it's just so stupid.
Yeah, it is a kind of fantasy language, you know, a kind of made up.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But to go back to the idea of that tree, it's the non-human that provides the objective view in your work. How did you sort of conceive of those prejudices of the characters that you use, and how much of that, Jess, this might be something for you, how much of that was predetermined or how much came out in sort of just the writing and development of the characters?
I think we knew early on that we wanted the Cinchona tree to be the voice of reason or the voice of some sort of more truthful narrator, whereas everyone else seems to be so unreliable. And I think that's partly to do with, you know, do you remember, Pilar, when we saw the tree itself, it sort of was standing slightly alone, and it was alone but in the mix of all of these other plants, and it was kind of underwhelming in terms of, like, I thought it would be this huge tree and, you know, quite spectacular because of that history and everything that it does and all the problems that it's caused and all the things that it's solved. And yet it's this sort of rather sort of spindly looking small tree that you just would walk past. You would never have any idea that it was so important. And I think that really cemented in my mind that, okay, that would be a lovely little whispering voice throughout, because that's what the tree looked like. But in terms of everybody else, I think that came largely from, we did a lot of eavesdropping at Kew, and it came from bits of that. And I think the guide in particular, there was something about that sort of, I think maybe slightly based on the guide that we walked around with, but I think it all came from the writing, really.
Yeah, I think it was more like this, using science as like a justification for the complete dismantling of like sovereign power from Indigenous peoples around the world. And also I was just thinking even about sisal and like rubber, Cinchona, they were like kind of the three main crops, and also very much in competition with the Portuguese, the Dutch, with the Spanish. There was actually a sample of Cinchona that we filmed. And this particular one was, it's a very old, it's the oldest specimen that they had. And it had first been taken by the Spanish, who had control of Peru at that time, and then was stolen by the Portuguese. And as it was coming across the ocean in a boat filled with other specimens, was attacked by the British, who took everything on that boat. And then that's kind of how it got to Kew, in that this little plant specimen had been through like battles, humans dying, like the how important this little you know, stick, and it wasn't even the whole plant, it was just a little stick with some leaves on it, how much that sample or that specimen had, yeah, it's just, for me it seemed completely crazy. But there was very much like a war, it was very much like a war between colonial states.
Power struggles, maybe.
Yeah, power struggles between these European countries, where, you know, very real people died trying to move plants around the world. But to be honest, I feel like this whole project sort of completely destabilizes all my kind of linear lines of thinking.
And that's an interesting thing, actually, because so much of your work stems from not personal experience, but, you know, these little sparks that come from your family history. And I guess there you've just zeroed in on why this tree or little stick part of it has become such a sort of flashpoint, because it does sort of cross over from your sort of family background, you know, family background where you live now. And so I guess there's a thing here in these tiny or seemingly insignificant non-human protagonists, to go back to what we were saying before, being these vessels that can contain so much when you sort of dive in behind them. And so, Jess, I wonder, is that something that comes up in the rest of your work, this idea that these sort of objects or other kinds of entities can act as little flashpoints for you?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, in terms of the Archers, the radio drama, the community there in Ambridge have their own treasures and their own. There's an awful lot of stuff that is sort of handed down from generation to generation in terms of events or the importance of the land or there's sort of hidden trinkets of things that are important beyond the people that are there. I'm even thinking of with the program that I work on, you know, we have actual maps of this place that is fictional, and we use these maps, and you know, we're really careful that if somebody says that they can get from one farm to another farm in a set amount of time, that they could actually do that, because you know, we know where the rivers are, we've plotted it all out. So I think those things and the land in particular can be really important for finding ideas and stories.
I love that idea that you have these maps and, you know, this whole thing. I mean, obviously they're actually running for a very, very long time. I have forgotten how long, but Jess, maybe you could remind me how long the Archers has been running.
75 years.
Yes.
75 years. That's actually longer than I thought.
But that's really lovely, this idea that there's this history and characterization of a land and a place that comes through this fictional story. And so that kind of leads me into something I was wondering, Pilar, which is this use of fiction to tell these story, you know, to convey this very real concept. It's obviously grown, you know, as we have just covered there, that, you know, Kew Gardens really, it stems from a sort of scientific impulse, but so much fiction is built in, again, as we've touched on, through the garden and the actual construct of the plants. What was it like for you working with this sort of overlay of fiction, the idea that you wanted to build something else upon that?
Well, I mean, I've worked with fiction in my work before, and I find dipping into that kind of storytelling, even referencing more traditional narrative in cinema and theatre, I like using those forms as touchstones in my art practice, because I feel like sometimes it helps the audience connect with the subject matter a little bit more easily. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, using a lexicon of more traditional storytelling, that even if, you know, I subvert that or I move away from it, or it becomes this weird overlay, which as it does in this film, I feel like there's something to grasp at, and also for me, I think that's important. And it was really wonderful getting to work with Jess on this, because Jess sort of has that skill to actually tell a comprehensible story, which I have a lot of trouble with. So I think it was kind of really fun, even though I made her make something that was completely incomprehensible in the end. It was a fun exercise to kind of think through these characters and what their motivations are, and then destabilize all of that with how everything's put together. And also even using the same actor who voices all of them, Emma Clark, that was another layer of confusion.
It's an interesting thing, because I hesitate to use the word soap opera around something like colonialism and empire. But there is something that kind of works across your project and just your day job of sorts, this idea that we use these dramas and fiction so fluently in soap operas and sort of more popular entertainment to touch upon quite heavy ideas and social concepts and things like that. You know, it's something that we've seen happen, you know, over the decades. I think, for example, I was reading quite recently, Jessica, that there's been a plot line in The Archers around, is it alcoholism? And sort of lots of younger characters into the drama. So it's something, I think, Pilar, that, as you say, it is a great introduction into this particular space of this work and the quite, you know, serious concepts that are built in around it. Is, you know, fiction gives us a place to welcome people in without judgment almost. You know, they can come in and listen and enter the space of the work without necessarily realizing immediately or feeling implicated in things until they sort of walk out and begin to think about it afterwards. So it's something that I think your work, as you say, it's something you've played with in the past in other works, and it works really beautifully in this space here. Speaking of that, sort of physically walking into the exhibition, it's really clear part of the disorientation that happens through that dialogue is the soundscaping. So the sort of directional quality of the voices. And I think, Jess, you mentioned earlier that, you know, the tree whispers because it's this small diminutive plant in the gardens, and that felt like the right voice for it. So were you able to speak a little bit more about how you came to those decisions about the intonation of those characters and the choices you made in sort of sculpting where they come from in the space?
So, I mean, I worked with a really great sound designer, Jaco Prantl, who lives here in Amsterdam, who also recorded a lot of the sound in at Q. But I really worked with him I sort of imagined that some voices like Cicerone would be more omnipresent throughout as like a dominant tour guide who's kind of taking the viewer along this path. And then, yeah, that the whisper would then be sort of pushed to try to undermine that voice. I sort of wanted the voices to kind of move around. It's sort of just to destabilize each other constantly. And even the voices that were in conversation sort of come from different spots, not always opposite each other, sometimes next to each other. They sort of come from, you know, I sort of imagine them moving around us, you know, almost like you are on a tour and everyone's kind of milling around.
Yeah, they're kind of being circled.
Yeah. When I first showed it at Tent in Rotterdam, it was actually in a corridor, in a already built corridor, and that because so much of the work is set in corridors, it sort of works quite well. Is like a, it feels like there's a lot of forward motion, and I think the way that the space funnels at Samstag is quite beautifully kind of pushing you in towards the image, and the sound sort of then envelops you.
Yes, so much of this work has had to sort of operate and ever in our minds. It's been quite a journey. Yeah, thank you so much. It was really interesting.
Thanks so much.
That was artist Pilar Mata Dupont and writer Jessica Bunch. The Ague is showing at Samstag until the 10th of December 2021. For more information, please see our website, or you can follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Samstag Museum. On Art is produced by the Samstag Museum of Art, University of South Australia. It is supported by the Gordon Darling Foundation and Solstice Podcasting. On Art is recorded and edited by Tilly Boulding. Thank you for listening.